This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The General Assembly continues its work in Indianapolis, and keeping a close eye on it, as many people are, is Andy Downs. He's the Executive Director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Purdue University, Fort Wayne. And Andy, as always, thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, I've been staying pretty busy at the General Assembly on a number of measures, and we know that they're, whittling down the pile that they have set up for themselves here when they opened up the session, about a month ago now, or just about a month ago, actually. And some of the major measures that are out there are some ones, of course, that will affect Northwest Indiana. One in particular that we're always interested in is what State Senator Eddie Melton, who's based out of the Gary and the Maryville area, is keeping an eye on. And this particular one is about economic development for the city of Gary. How does this seem to stand right now? I know it's gotten some good response, at least in the General Assembly. It's already gone through most of the process already, hasn't it?
Yeah, you know, this is an interesting time of the session because it's still early enough that for a lot of people they're not paying attention. But there are things that kind of slip through quickly, and this could be one of those things that does manage to move through, at least out of the first chamber, quickly. What people need to remember is that February 25th or 26th, depending on which chamber you're talking about, is the last day for third reading in the House of Origin.
Mm-hmm.
And so a bill that starts in the House has to make it out by has to have its third reading by the 25th. A bill that starts in the Senate has to have its third reading by the 26th. And then things actually get, more complicated and, in some respects, a little more difficult to follow. But if you can get a bill to move through quickly and at this point in the session, congratulations to you, and you're a happy camper.
That's what seems to be the case here in this one here, because it's a rather complicated bill, and it's got only slightly less complicated because one element in it involving the casinos in Northwest Indiana, or in Gary in particular, has already been taken out. It's not part of this particular bill, but it too is going to make its way through, I guess, in the form of another bill or as part of another bill, right?
If you want to complicate your life, add gaming to whatever bill it is you're trying to deal with. That's the advice that I give to people who are looking to have the most complicated life possible. We knew that stuff was going to happen this year as far as gaming is concerned because of the sports betting issue. And for a lot of people, there was just this assumption that we would add sports betting because we already have the casinos and lottery, et cetera. And they said, oh, well, they'll add sports betting in Indiana. But when it comes right down to it, it actually doesn't generate as much revenue as a lot of people were thinking. And there still are people who find gambling and games of chance as objectionable or morally objectionable. So some of those things won't move. But the moment sports betting got put on the table, then gaming in general, and that, of course, means casinos or casinos moving, which, as far as Northwest Indiana is concerned, is a pretty big deal.
We know that this measure in particular is dealing with not only with the sports gaming, but all these other little odds and ends of gaming. And, of course, that includes dealing with the two gambling licenses that are set up in casinos in Northwest Indiana, and Gary in particular. And we know that they still have yet to work out exactly, I suppose, who might get that second casino license that is now currently at the casinos in Gary. Do any clue with what you've heard in talking at the State House as to where it might go?
You know, that's an Ed Feigenbaum question. He's the one who has the insight into those sorts of things. And I know he comes on the show. He's on a little bit ago with you. He's the person to ask about that. That is, I'm somebody who believes that the process should be open and visible for everybody. But gaming stuff can really be one of those things that takes place in the hallways, people running into each other, having conversations, working through details, because these are significant issues. The industry itself, heavily regulated, but generates a lot of jobs, generates a lot of revenue for communities. And so you can understand why people would want to get one if they can. And then on the other side, you have the folks who just complain that this is a bad industry, it's not really good economic development, et cetera. A former legislator I know who polled on the issue numerous times over the course of his career said that it was always a 51-49 issue. 51% either loved it or disliked it, and 49% was the opposite. He said that gaming is just, it's one of those really difficult issues. and he was always happy when it was not about his district.
Yeah, I can imagine. One of the other issues that's come up even just in review just recently is a question about gun laws. The topic's come back up at the State House, and I guess even as early as this week, it's kind of been brought out in the open, at least for the open, some type of open discussion.
Yeah, there. Jim Lucas is a legislator who is someone you could pretty much bank on to introduce legislation regarding guns, and he's done that again, sponsored and or helped to push some legislation regarding guns. And the Democrats just yesterday, I think it was, may have been the day before, publicly stood up and said with some members of the community, you know, we know the dangers of guns. Why can't we have a discussion about things like background checks, et cetera? Because to the best of my knowledge, none of the weapons legislation introduced by Democrats has gotten a hearing even, while some of the bills introduced by Republicans have. And for those who are wondering, there are something like 25, 26 bills about guns, one way or another, that were introduced this session.
Wow. It's hard to believe that there are that many, but it's not surprising. One of the other issues, too, I know that is brought up not only about guns, but about liquor in particular. We've dealt with the, or at least we thought we did, had dealt with the cold beer sales lately. But now the questions come up here, I guess, in general, just about liquor stores and the like, too. And in fact, you had a chance to talk with an Indianapolis Star reporter not long ago for a story that's in IndyStar.com here about cold beer sales. How is it that's come up, even though that supposedly we thought this was had already been resolved to some point in the General Assembly, is this all kind of resurfaced again?
When the Sunday sales legislation passed, there were two schools of thought that I was hearing from people. One was that, okay, alcohol bills, they're just not going to go anywhere now. People will still introduce them, but, you know, we did the big thing. We went to Sunday sales, and now we'll just sit quietly, and none of these bills will go anywhere. The other school of thought was, nope, now everything will tumble from here. But the reality is, whether it was Sunday sales or now cold sales, these are issues for which legislators are able to find backing in their communities. If you poll in your community, you can find people who support both positions, so to speak, allow it, don't allow it here, don't allow it there. And as I have often said, until legislators see clear indication from the public that they want something, for something as complicated and tricky as alcohol, they can leave it alone and it doesn't cost them anything. It's just, you know, a headache during the session, then they can leave it alone and move on to other things. What brought up the what you're mentioning here, Kyle Hupfer, the state chair for the Republican Party and former Secretary of Commerce under the Daniels administration, are now a part of a group that owns a series of liquor stores. And the question was, well, does that mean that the cold sales issue is going to come up again, or does that mean it's been defeated forever? That will be an interesting question to watch now. Part of the point that I made was, even if the state chair says absolutely nothing to anybody about this ever again, there will be some legislator who gets in his or her head, I want to get in good with the state chair, so I'm going to introduce legislation that does A, B, or C because they believe that's what the state chair would want.
Right.
And that's going to put the state chair in an awkward position. But, you know, this is the nature of people who want to please a boss or somebody higher up. We'll have to wait and see where it goes. I think that we probably won't see anything this session, in part because of that recent acquisition by that group that Hupfer's a part of.
One of the other things, too, in relationship to this particular issue is a question that's come up, although not necessarily, I guess, in the liquor laws review, but also in some other issues that come up. You would think that it would come out more often, but conflict of interest is one of these topics, and we've seemed to be finding more cases like that this particular session, aren't we? In fact, the latest thing that came up here has just come out in recent weeks has been an issue that would involve the child labor laws in Indiana. But that now has come up as maybe a possible conflict of interest, too.
Yeah, one of the challenges, and very quickly for those who don't know, Chip Perfect, a member of the General Assembly, owns a ski resort, basically, a winter sports place, and employs a fair number of young folks. He introduced some legislation that would change child labor laws in the state of Indiana. And so people said, well, is this a conflict of interest or not? That was the basic question. He actually took the legislation to the Ethics Committee in the General Assembly and said, what do you think? This is a group of bipartisan group that will look at things and help legislators identify where conflicts exist and don't exist. But this all, in many respects, comes out of the fact that we have a part-time legislature. And when you have a part-time legislature, that means that people have day jobs, and those day jobs actually give them content knowledge that is useful in committee discussions. So you take somebody who is a teacher, for example, and throw them into the General Assembly, and, well, there's a pretty good idea that you might want to have them on an education committee because they actually know something about education, but you've also then created many, many opportunities for conflicts of interest. And that's the problem here. What Perfect had suggested was not something that would benefit his businesses only, but would affect all businesses employing child labor. And he has actually now pulled it and basically said, let's do this as a study committee. Let's not try to pass anything right now, because there was a fair amount of attention. In fact, the Washington Post even wrote an article about this, saying, this looks an awful lot like a conflict of interest. How on earth can somebody who employs hundreds of young people be introducing legislation that affects their employment? And so, you know, it got a little more attention than usual, but this conflict or the appearance of conflict is something that happens every session, in part because of the part-time legislature. Yeah.
I'd like to cover some other things, too, and we get back together again here soon and talk, Andy. And one in particular, you referred to about the fact that we're at this point now, we're very close to it, that we're going to see the fact that bills of their origination in the chamber now have to be passed to make it over for review in the other chamber. And a couple of measures in particular I'd like to see what happened will be with some Northwest Indiana lawmakers. Ed Charbonneau from Valparaiso in particular, and his measure involving water has gotten out of the Senate, and I'm sure it's going to come up soon if it hasn't already in the House. And also, Ed Soliday from Valparaiso has the bill, which we are watching closely, is about trying to upgrade the Porter County election system. It's gotten out of the House, and now it's headed to the Senate, and I'm sure you'd like to get some of your views about that. So we'll keep an eye on those, and we'll be back in touch, and we'll have you back on to talk about those and some of the other measures that make it over to the other House and or the other chamber, I should say, rather, not the House in this particular case, but to find out how these things are coming along, too. And we want to thank you for spending some time with us to cover some of these big issues that have come up, and certainly in particular the ones that seem to have gotten a little more attention than others. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll have you back on very soon.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I look forward to it.
Andy Downs is the Executive Director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Purdue University, Fort Wayne. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. These next stories come to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
So I knew that I was like, I liked guys and girls when I was like 13, and I was like, this is really weird. This is uncomfortable. This isn't normal. So I suppressed the unnormal part till I came to college. And it was mostly my peer group and just having those conversations and growing up as a person, realizing that I've struggled with who I am for 10 years, and it's made me really depressed and like I've had bad thoughts and like, it's made me not want to live. Like, I really enjoy this life thing, so I want to give it a shot. And part of that is accepting who I am. So it was as much of being around people who are accepting as learning to accept myself. And honestly, the, like, homophobia that I felt was not because I think it's wrong or whatever. It's because it scares me that it showed up in my life. I think that was the big thing. And just realizing that my life was spiraling downward, and realizing that I do have influence on accepting myself. I mean, I can accept myself for who I am. So opening that up and just realizing your life is going downward. That was the part that really changed me. And like being on with people I trusted and who legitimately loved me for me helped that process like grow and bloom. What I struggle with is when people single out a single sin. If it is, I don't know. It's very confusing. If it's a sin, we cannot single that out because we're all sinners. I'm really good. I'm a champion sinner. I do it every day. So just singling out a sin isn't fair. And I was singling it out in myself and singling it out in others and realizing that this whole grace thing rocks. Let's just have grace and live more graceful lives. I don't want people to have to change what they believe in their theology. I want people to be accepting and welcoming and tolerant of people for where they're at. Like, everybody's different. If we all were the same, life would suck. And I just want people to hold true to their theology while promoting welcoming environments for everybody, regardless of what your background is, what your story is.
Miller has been, I wouldn't want to live any other place. This is because of the beach and the people. They're all open-minded people. When the blacks started moving here, I have to admit, there were some people who didn't like that, but I was not one. Jack Spratt's ice cream parlor was something else. You used to wait in line halfway down the block on Lake Street to get ice cream at Jack Spratt's. Janice worked there one summer. It was wonderful, but she said, "Mom, the basement there is terrible." That's what she said about it. But she said, "You can't beat the ice cream." Where that nice restaurant is now, that was a bakery, a real nice bakery. Where Ming Ling went out, that was a drugstore. The big stores closed. They went out to Merrillville. We had a beautiful Sears. My mother worked for Sears 30 years. The biggest department store, H. Gordon and Son, was right on the corner of 8th and Broadway. Palace Theater was here. This was Gordon's, and over here, there was a corner Walgreens and then the Palace Theater. And across the street, there was a movie there. Yeah, Gary changed. I guess it's because, I have to be honest, it was probably because of blacks moving in. It didn't affect me, but it affected a lot of people. It didn't affect me. And then the mall, the stores moved out to Merrillville. So downtown Gary stores and the Palace Theater was a beautiful theater. That closed. I think it's still, I don't go, there's no reason for me to go downtown. The shoe store stayed open longer because the owners were not anti-black. People that were anti-black closed their business and went to Merrillville. That's all I can say about them. I knew the people that owned those stores. They didn't want to leave Gary. They had customers here. But when most of the bigger places moved out to Merrillville, they lost their customers here in Gary. But physically, I didn't have the stores to go to. I had to go to Merrillville too. I was stuck.
You can find more stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. The state of Indiana has launched a new work requirement program through Medicaid this month. It's called Gateway to Work, and it's being billed as a community engagement opportunity to help connect people with better employment opportunities. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan tells us that there's some concerns from some that the changes are going to mean Hoosiers would lose health insurance.
Indiana was one of the first states to apply for and receive a federal waiver to implement work requirements for the state's Medicaid expansion program, HIP 2.0. Indiana's Gateway to Work launched at the beginning of this year. Jennifer Walthall is the state's Family and Social Services Administration's, or FSSA, secretary.
It's actually more about connecting people to things that they haven't been able to be connected to before.
Things like education and transportation. Indiana is only the second state to make the move, and the FSSA set a goal early in the process.
We're not going to lose people because of a reporting requirement or an administrative burden or something along those lines.
But many worry they will, and there is precedent for this worry. In Arkansas, the first state to implement similar requirements, more than 12,000 residents lost their health insurance. Many couldn't easily access the online-only reporting system. But Walthall says Indiana's system is easy and user-friendly, and not all online. Members can log work, volunteer, or school hours on computer, by phone, and in person, and they don't have to have documentation.
they'll just go in and say, hey, I volunteered for 20 hours this week, check, and it goes right through and gets the job done. We're not trying to make this a full-time job. We're actually trying to help people get real full-time jobs, and so we don't want to get in their way.
The state will work through existing workforce development programs to help people find better employment. Gateway to Work gives people a list of what it calls partners to help them find jobs or volunteer opportunities. So far, there are more than 200 listed on the website.
We would like to have a cohort of people that are looking for those who have been disenfranchised for a long time and help us do our job better. We can't do this by ourselves.
But some partners are skeptical. Maurice Young works with people relying on Medicaid. He's an advocate for people experiencing homelessness in Indianapolis. Every Wednesday, he hands out bagged lunches at the Central Library.
There you go. You're welcome.
He and his small team also help people navigate health care coverage for HIP 2.0 and other programs.
And then Keenan over there, he does Humana for people who don't know that there's extra benefits that they get after they're on it for a year or so.
Young feels like FSSA is relying too much on the partners who work with these communities.
And it's so funny because when you read through the presentation, the partners do the work, right? The partners are the ones supposed to find the volunteer opportunities. Okay, I can find volunteer opportunities, but how am I supposed to get them there? This is your program. Get them some bus tickets.
He'd rather see a carrot than a stick approach.
Just open it up and offer it, but don't require it as a quid pro quo for your health.
Not all recipients of HIP 2.0 are subject to the new work requirement restrictions. A majority of the more than 400,000 Hoosiers on HIP 2.0 will be exempt for a number of reasons, including age, medical frailty, substance use disorder, and homelessness. But Young says those categories aren't clear in real life. Homelessness is not clear.
Those institutions have different definitions of homelessness. So give me that information.
FSSA Secretary Jennifer Walthall knows it will be hard to reach every one of the estimated 70 to 80,000 people who may have to comply with the work changes. They've gone through partners, providers, and reached out directly to members through email or letters to get the word out.
The hardest folks to reach are the most important to reach.
Members aren't required to report any hours the first 6 months. The full 20-hour-a-week requirement won't be in place until 2020. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. We always look at big businesses as the ones that help drive communities, but that's not always the case. Many times, it's the small businesses, and even the smaller, almost the better, are the ones that are really the lifeblood of a community. They're the ones that are the most involved in not only a community's business expansion, but also the fact that schools do well, cultural activities, and all residents, they all get engaged because of small businesses. Well, owners of small businesses in Northwest Indiana now have a new advocate, and we get to talk with him. Philip McCandies is the Regional Business Development Officer here in Lake County for an organization which is called the Community Investment Fund of Indiana. And Philip, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, if you will,
I really appreciate it.
Well, I mean, if you will explain for us what the Community Investment Fund of Indiana is all about. They really are kind of a financial lifeblood, I'm sure, to many small businesses in the Hoosier State.
Yes, we are a nonprofit. We are, you know, a CDFI, and we are literally just a micro lender. We're here to serve the community from the ground with the community and with the business owners that are working within the community.
Are they basically, I guess, a kind of a conduit between banks or other lending institutions and the businesses themselves?
Yeah, we want to be that partner with the banks and with the community to usher them to the banks, because a lot of the time small businesses do not realize what the requirements are for banks, because banks look for specific requirements from specific businesses, and some just go at it in the dark, and they just had a little. If they had a little guidance, we could help them get there.
When you talk about establishing small businesses and the small business community in general, they're really a kind of a mosaic, aren't they, of what business is really like here. They're making up all kinds of different sizes of businesses. I guess different types of people that are business people. They're not your cut and dried ones, are they?
No, they're not. We want to lend to the mission of each individual business, and we are mission driven. So we want to support the mission of each individual business in that unique way. So there might be some businesses that there are a couple of businesses that came to me needing. At first, they thought they needed capital, but they actually needed social capital.
Uh-huh.
They needed to be put into place with the right people. They needed to put in. They needed a different marketing tool. They needed to be put to somebody that actually could introduce them to a bigger outlet for their product. You know, so it always for us, it's always about getting the right type of capital to the client and to the entrepreneur in the community, which is not always financial, which is what we like to provide, and we want to provide that. But some of them we do not want to overcapitalize and overfund. And a lot of the times that these good business owners in Northwest Indiana, a lot of times they just need a nudge in the right direction, a little encouragement. And some of them, two or three of them, were like, you know, let me stop for the loan right now. I see what you did. And they turned it. They made a couple of changes, and they didn't even need us. And I tried to get a loan to them.
Have you found, and this is probably the case all across the state for that matter too, that many of the small businesses that the Community Investment Fund of Indiana and your office that you work as a regional office here in Lake County in particular get to work with, are these folks that are people that may be getting a business underway, maybe trying to help take over a business for a family member that maybe has passed on or just have turned over the business to somebody in the younger generation? And so that's why these are great people that are taking over business. They maybe know the business well, but they're not quite as skilled on the financial end of this. And this is why that they turn to people like you.
Yes, that's correct. A lot of the time when there is a business passed on, there is a somewhat of a financial taking from the person that is acquiring. That's just the business. And a lot of the time, those people will have either worked for the business or they're just, it may have been, you know, a medical condition, or it just may have just been left in a will to them. And they want to just, you know, take it over for their parents and continue the legacy. For whatever reason it is, helping them get that education and get them the right technical assistance always comes back to not just our bottom line, but it also comes back to the bottom line of the community. We always want to be the CDFI for the city, so or the region or the state. We want our CDFI to be your CDFI. So if you need us and you come to us for resources about how to do your accounting, we want to be that resource for you. You know, we want to make sure we get you to the proper people in the area. So we're not just going to put one CPA over here because that might not fit how you do business. We will give you a host of CPAs that we've worked with in the area, and we will give you a list, and we would advise you to go talk to each individual one to help you with your business. And that, in turn, helps them run the business better, helps them create, you know, track their cash flow, and helps us create a proper loan package for them.
We're talking with Philip McCandies. He is the new Regional Business Development Officer here in Lake County for the Community Investment Fund of Indiana. The fund itself, of course, is based in Indianapolis and branches out all across the state. And we've talked here in particular about small businesses and getting them off to a good start and getting them financial off in the right direction to the lenders and the other organizations that will help them make their particular business grow well. Does it branch out as well to the community? Are there organizations or nonprofits that the CIFI works with to help make them grow? In particular, we're talking about housing and being able to help get assistance to folks that are particularly low income, at risk organizations and the like. Do you folks help out there too?
Yes, we do. We one of our partners is the Northwest Indiana Reinvestment Alliance with Jean Ishman, and we partner with her because they're like our big brother, big sister mm-hmm. in this community. That partnership has helped us learn the language. Even though I live in the region, I've lived here the last 8 years. It's actually from a business standpoint that helps us establish the language and how things are done in Northwest Indiana. I think they're done very properly. I think they're done well. People are working together because a lot of people, with Jean, she would introduce me to all these different businesses that come to her for help on the housing side. And what I found is that was a way to alleviate that I'm not a bank, and not to say that banks are bad or anything like that, but I want to make sure that I'm here to help them get the proper funds rather than just try to get them any amount of funds that I can give them.
Because in many cases, I suppose you have a chance because even though you work very closely with lenders, with banks and other organizations, they probably have special needs that maybe they have to find other ways to get the financing from, don't they?
Yes, they do. One thing that I'm in tune with what I do, I'm working on my PhD, and what I found is some of the barriers are just the barriers to social capital utilization. Or it's just knowledge. It's knowledge and how to get the type of knowledge you need from the environment that your business is operating in. See, a lot of people in Northwest Indiana work together. And like Jean, she was introducing me to a lot of people, and I didn't know that they came to her as an influencer to find where they needed to get the next deal or to get to the next project that they were looking to do. Or get to the perfect lender or however. And that is one of the things that we look to do. We look to partner with the local influencers to make sure that, you know, we're here on the ground, not trying to, influence it, but we're trying to support the influencers in the community. So, we want to make sure that we are properly and have and get rooted here so that we can stay here for a long time.
I know one of the agencies and nonprofit organizations that you all work with closely is the Lake County Community Economic Development Department. That's a long title. I'm sure I get it right. Tell us more how you fit in with them and how they've been able to help your particular area with the Community Investment Fund of Indiana.
So, with them, our partnership is similar to that of Gene and them. So they get a lot of inquiries about the economic development that's going on in the whole Lake County, all Northwest Indiana. And so we're able to lend specifically to certain things that they might not be able to lend to. Or a bank might come to them and say, okay, well, we're looking to fund this type of deal here. We're looking to fund this housing project, or we're looking to fund this restaurant that is trying to expand. Well, they might refer them to us as a partner to make sure that, because we might have some extra funds, some CRA funds, or some technical assistance that we can offer them. So it works hand in hand, and I'm just glad to be in the game with them and with everybody here, so that we can continue to inject capital into the community.
I know, too, that the among the other things that you mentioned, and you have the experience and the education in working as a counselor and I guess in a way as a mentor, too, you're able to help direct people in their small businesses if they're not familiar with a certain aspect of what they're doing, or comes back to what we talked about, they've taken over a business as a family member, taken over a family business in particular. You help work with organizations like SCORE, don't you, and the other mentors that are out there in the community that will help these folks grow their businesses.
Yes, we do. We work with SCORE. We work with the ISBDC, Indiana Small Business Development Center. We work with the SBA. And the one thing that we do is the reason we work with all these organizations is because they have a lot of big time resources as far as market research, different types of classes, different types of resources that some entrepreneurs may not have the financial capabilities to attain on their own. There are some classes on grants that they can achieve that we're not able to provide for them. So I look at it as an essential part of my toolbook to have good relationships with Lori Felt at the Indiana Small Business Development Center out in South Bend, and the SCORE people here in Northwest Indiana. Then you have Sharon Harvey, who's with the SBA. She's all over the state all the time, and she's giving me calls almost every other week asking me to, could I talk to a business owner in Lake County and give them some technical assistance. So I see it as it all is, a lot of people might look at it as a chaos, but I look at it as like football. It's organized chaos. And it's almost like a symphony. And like, I believe Northwest Indiana is really thriving right now. And from what I've heard about where it is now to where it was and all the economic development that is going on and that is planned to happen. I'm very happy and excited.
One of the things I know that as a member of the business community yourself, working with the Community Investment Fund of Indiana, you get a chance to work not only with small businesses, but you have kind of a small business attitude yourself. You're working out of one of the newest phenomena, if you want to call it that, that's here available here in Northwest Indiana, the Green Cow co-working space. How did you particularly get involved in that, and what has that helped kind of benefited you as part of the small business community?
Well, here at Green Cow, Lee, he's the director of it, and Green Cow is a space where entrepreneurs or consultants or people who just are any type of entrepreneur, that they can get out of their home. Mm-hmm. And I think an environment like this helps entrepreneurs change their mindset, because when you leave your regular 9-to-5 to pursue your dream and your passion of being a business owner, somehow you have to trigger the same type of motivation that you had going to a 9-to-5. And the Green Cow does that. It gets you around other entrepreneurs that are doing different things. There's insurance agents, there's lawyers, there's professional, there's life coaches, there are computer consultants who they write software, so they're in here on their computer with their headphones on, typing away, locked in, coding. And then there's, you know, people like me who are in here doing consulting and, you know, micro lending and helping the community. And I'm out there able to ask questions. I'm able to get referrals to different businesses or different networking events so that I stay relevant, so that I stay interacting, so that I stay answering questions and providing just the technical assistance that they need. And it's a great environment to have space, to have meetings for entrepreneurs. So if you're ever over in Hammond, anybody, check out Green Cow, ask for Lee. He will take care of you. He's a great guy.
That's interesting, and we find that there are so many small businesses. They, like you just mentioned here, they're too small, I guess, to be in a big environment, in a big space environment. But they need to have some place to work out of too. And this seems to work out very well. Well, in your particular situation, since you are in contact with so many people about so many different aspects of the business world, tell us now if anybody is interested in finding out more about what you do with the Community Investment Fund of Indiana. How can they get in touch with you and find out more, and how you can help them out as a mentor, a counselor, as well as aiming them in the right direction as far as lending and that sort of thing is concerned?
Well, my phone number here is 219-779-7870. My email is pmccandies@capitalizingindiana.org.
And that's capitalizing one big one word, capitalizing.
Yeah,
Indiana.
One big word. It's one big word, and I talked. I think it fits. It may be a long word, but it does fit what we want to do. Help capitalize Indiana.
Philip McCandies is the Regional Business Development Officer here in Lake County for the Community Investment Fund of Indiana. It's an organization that is helping small businesses get off in the right direction if they need it financially, as well as if they have questions, you can also direct them to the right people on counseling and mentoring. It's all one way that small businesses here in Northwest Indiana, if they need the help, they can find the help and continue on the road to success and build their businesses to become successful with businesses. And Mr. McCandies, thank you very much for spending time talking about what you do for other businesses and what they, in turn, I'm sure, can lend some help to you as well, too.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Crown Point resident Heather Zikovich accepted a task, which was her late father's wish, to complete and to publish a children's Christmas book. It's a book co-authored by her dad, by the way, Bob Morgan, and herself. It's entitled, Is My Grandpa Santa's Elf? And I had a chance to sit down recently with Heather here at Lakeshore Public Radio to talk about her dad, about the journey that led to the book that has come out here this past November. And here's our conversation. Tell us about your dad, what he really wanted to do and never seemed to tell anybody about.
My dad, he had a very big personality and lots of dreams and big dreams. He never really went small. And I think he just wanted to leave behind this gift for us to have, like this legacy that will be here long after I'm here. And he just really wanted a part of him still here with us. So it was really cool to find.
When did you learn that even an idea that he had these plans and goals to write a children's book?
Well, years ago, he's always had projects or just little ideas he was working on for years. And years ago, he mentioned something about it, and I probably gave him the, yeah, okay, but I kind of forgot about it. And then it was literally probably about 3 or 4 hours before he passed, and we were in his hospital room, and he had one of those CPAP machines on, and he took it off, and he's like, hey, Heath, come here. I'm like, what's up, Dad? Just relax. You're okay. And he said, sign on to that computer over there. It was the hospital computer. And I said, Dad, I can't do that. And he's like, I want to show you something I've been working on. And I said, okay. I said, well, what is it? He's like, a children's book that I started, you know, back 4 or 5 years ago that I want you to find and finish for me. And I said, you know what, Dad? I'll do whatever. You know, sure. As you know, I'll find it. As soon as I get home, I'll find everything and I'll do it for you. And he kind of, you could tell it was kind of on that bucket list of last few thoughts, you know, and he's like, okay. And then he was kind of like, thanks, you know, and it kind of just checked that off his list. And he's like, all right, that's cool. You'll do it. And I went and sat back down where I was sitting by him and I said, Dad, I will finish it for you. And he's like, all right, thanks, Heather.
Now, when was that, by the way?
So he passed away April of 2017. Mm-hmm. So last year.
So it's been within less than 2 years now, actually, for the whole process to begin. What did, as soon as your father passed and you had to go through the ordeal that everybody goes through when a loved one passes away, and you kind of dust things off and pick things up and figure out, well, what do we do with this? Yeah. What got you started to get onto the actual journey that you had now to follow through on what your dad wanted you to do?
Literally, he passed away in Indianapolis, and literally that morning when we got home, because he passed away around 7 in the morning, that morning, 9, 10 o'clock, I went to his house, and I was just on a mission because I felt like it was a part of, it was meant to be that way, and I was just ready to just find everything and get started and just use it as a way to keep our relationship going, you know? And so I literally went home, got on his computer, found print. He told me where to find, like, the different files he saved, found it, printed everything I could, and the crazy part is, you know, like a week later, his computer bit the dust.
Really?
Yeah.
What a good timing that you did everything just before everything would have locked up and you'd had to go to an IT specialist to get it unlocked, I suppose, and get all that back out. Well, tell us now, did he leave you enough files that you could actually go through? Did he lay things out well enough that you could take everything together, the copy, the pictures, and everything together and with the right kind of professional help to get on the road to getting this thing published?
Yep. He basically had... the first thing I found was his whole idea, which my dad had, like I said, big ideas, and he always was in excess. And so tons of run-on sentences, you know, I had to go through and weed out. But his main idea was there on a couple of sheets of paper that, you know, I want it to be told in the voice of my oldest granddaughter. Her name was Chloe. He called her Kay Rose, so that's who tells the story in the book. So he had everything laid out pretty much, but I had to kind of figure out an ending of the book. So the main chunk of the book is him, and then the ending was more me.
Do you think that maybe this layout was including the pitch that you knew that he would have to make if he was able to do it himself to some publisher to tell him, this is why I want you to do my book?
Do I what?
It's like pitching an idea for a movie or something like
yeah.
that. But in this case, you'd have to be pitching it to a publisher about mm-hmm. Telling him, said, this is why I want you to put right. my book into print.
I always said, leave it to him to, you know, move to heaven and, you know, leave this world on a promotional marketing thing, because that was his whole life. He, you know, was so creative and had just such a love for cool things, and just he never had a small dream, you know. So him going out of this world on this kind of, right. you know, that not made it easy, but his story behind it made it a good marketing thing. So really it was like he did his own marketing before he left.
Now we know what the title is. We know the ideas that your dad had put into that computer that you've been able to retrieve and start out on the mission. What did you do when you had chance with your hands, so to speak, on all those files to actually get it to go to the publisher and say, here's what he's got, an idea, here's what he wants us to do?
I just really spent a lot of late nights. I mean, with grief as it is, you can't sleep well. So I spent a lot of those late nights just up till 2 to 4 o'clock in the morning, just submitting everywhere, you know, nothing was too small. So really it's just about not giving up and just being persistent. And I mean, you're going to get mostly no's.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, Mascot Publishing is a smaller publisher, but it was perfect for us. So I just didn't give up, and I was persistent, and it worked out.
Now, who did you get in touch with at the publishing house? Which editors did you get to work with who took on this project?
His name was Daniel Wheatley. He was the project manager for it, and he just kind of, it was a lot of mostly me and then submitting to him and them more so like editing and, you know, cleaning it up and putting it, you know, bringing it to life. So, yep, he was the main guy I worked with there, but everyone I worked with there was very good to work for.
You tell us about the fellow who was the project manager. What did he tell you, or you probably learned along the way, that he had to do to take the information that you got from your dad, mm-hmm. from the computer, and send on to him to be able to get it to finally be in print?
So basically you have an idea, and then you create a manuscript and just clean up, spend lots and lots of time cleaning up that manuscript. And then you go back and forth a lot, and then you submit the clean final version of the manuscript. And then they turn that into, you know, actually after that, then you find an illustrator. They sent me a big list of people, mm-hmm. and I had to choose, you know, the work that I thought, the whole time I was thinking in my dad's brain, you know. And I had to choose from a whole bunch. The illustrator actually is Monica Nicolsi. She's from Italy, which I thought was pretty cool. And so I chose the illustrator. We went, you know, with the storyboard, did that, and then just kind of cleaned up the whole book.
One of the folks at Purdue University Northwest had to say about this, I'm sure you probably got hold of some folks in the communications department and got a little advice along the way to help you through this process.
Right. Actually, my counselor at Purdue was Beth Rudnick, and she has been amazing. And she, you know, spread the word at Purdue. And so they actually contacted me, and, you know, I talked to a few different people there, and they have just been a huge help through this all. I grew up like a really shy kid, but going to school at Purdue and just the different professors and different, I majored in is liberal studies with emphasis in communications and OLS. And just that whole, like, I stayed home and went to college, but it just gave me confidence. That mm-hmm. school, if anything, just gave me confidence, and just everyone I worked with there was amazing. And then just, like I said, full circle even to, you know, have them help me so much with the promotion of my dad's book.
From what you know now, the journey you have taken on this here, what advice would you give to somebody who might be not in the same unfortunate circumstances, but somebody who has taken on this project, maybe a family member has just decided they don't want to deal with it anymore, but you're not going to give up and you want to take on whatever somebody has already started to work on, how would you advise them into following through to making sure they can reach the same sort of goals that you have with this published children's book?
As for a book or just in general?
We'll try the book, and then in general.
Okay. So I would just, number one, don't think you can't do it and just never give up and just, you know, give it everything you have, because once it's completed, that's, you know, out there forever.
That's Heather Zickovich, who, with her father, Bob Morgan, are the co-authors of the book, which is entitled, Is My Grandpa Santa's Elf? The book is published, by the way, by Mascot Books, and you can find it with Mascot Books on their website or through any of the other online booksellers that will get you to this interesting book, a very, very inspirational book. It's more than just a Christmas book. It's a book that will tell you something about life as well as what Heather has told us about, too. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.